In Mississippi, hundreds of workers are rounded up by immigration officials. Some had kids who were going through the rituals of the first day of the new school year.
Dressed up for school, you got your new backpack, all your school supplies, and then this horror happens. I can't imagine the terror that they must have faced.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, in Indian-controlled Kashmir, a dangerous change to the status quo.
What India has done is essentially a calling card for any jihadists in the region to kind of take up arms and organize themselves.
And a provocative young singer-songwriter in Brazil tells her own story.
My album is telling my history, and I think that is really powerful for a lesbian woman to say her history.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Federal officials say they were the largest immigration raids in a decade. To the people who experienced them, the raids were traumatic.
I saw something very violent, like an invasion with a lot of agents, a lot of buses, black trucks detaining people from the plant. It was very, like a horror movie.
That's Luis Cartagena. He's a pastor from Morton, Mississippi. His town was one of several where ICE agents detained nearly 700 immigrant workers at poultry plants across the state. Dozens of the people detained were released today, but the impact on the broader communities is still being felt. Amelia McGowan is an attorney at the Mississippi Center for Justice. She fielded calls from frightened children and other relatives of the people targeted by ICE agents.
They were at home and their family members were working and their family members just didn't come home. I got a call from a young woman who was panicked because she had spoken with several young people who couldn't find their parents. They were all having trouble just getting basic information on where their parents were, if their parents were going to come home. Really a lot of chaos and confusion.
It was also the first day of school for some children in Mississippi. What did that mean for the school kids whose parents were swept up in these raids? Like, when did they find out?
It had to have been terrifying. I can't even imagine what it had to have been like. You know, obviously you're, you know, dressed up for school. You got your new backpack, all your school supplies, and then this horror happens. I can't imagine the terror that they must have faced. You know, this is going to ruin the whole school year, obviously. But yeah, I just can't imagine what it's got to be like.
And do you know when these school kids found out what had happened to their parents? Was it during the school day?
Some of those children knew pretty early in the day that this had happened. Other students, I understand, were coming home in the buses. And I understand that in some counties, the bus drivers were given instructions not to drop off children if, you know, they couldn't actually view anybody in the house.
Wow.
It's been unclear what happened to the children after that. I've heard rumors that some of the children actually went back to the schools. And unfortunately, I don't know what happened to a lot of those children.
One of the clients you're representing is a 19-year-old asylum seeker. Can you tell us her story? Like, when and where was she taken into custody yesterday?
She was working at one of the plants in one of the communities that was raided. She and her relative had the early shift, and two other relatives had the later shift. So they were actually at home. As they were leaving, as they were preparing to leave the workplace, they were arrested and taken in. The family members found out and actually got a very tearful call from the family members saying they didn't know what happened to them. Yeah, and it was just very difficult for them and even me to get information about what had happened.
How much access to legal aid do your clients have, and how much access do you have to your clients?
So I've got both, you know, clients who are involved and also family members of clients or just community members who called me yesterday. It's been very difficult to find information. Of course, a lot of rumors going around. The other tremendous issue is legal access. So in Mississippi, there are very few nonprofit pro bono immigration legal service providers. I've been extremely proud. In Mississippi, our lawyers have really stepped up, both those who have immigration backgrounds and others who have family law backgrounds who are interested in helping children whose maybe parents or guardians were arrested.
I mean, there is talk of some swift deportations possibly coming up. I mean, are you concerned that you might not actually be able to access your clients before they're put on a plane?
Yes, very concerned. So for people who have outstanding removal orders, people who have been removed in the past, I understand their removal is going to be very quick. For others, others will have a right to see an immigration judge, but many, as I understand that many people are taken to detention centers in Louisiana. in very rural locations where legal access is also very difficult.
Have these raids just put a pall across the kind of wider communities you serve?
Absolutely. And, you know, I have clients who have legal status. We represent a lot of people who have gotten asylum, and many live in that area and are terrified of what will happen with them. Because now they're concerned that even if they have status, that they'll be perceived not to have status and be arrested. We heard rumors yesterday of people who had status and were interrogated and things like that. So that fear is absolutely there. And I can't imagine the fear and trauma that children are facing, even going to school. Obviously, their school year is going to be marred. And, you know, I think teachers are affected, school administrators are affected, childcare workers are affected, churches are affected, everyone's affected.
Amelia McGowan, an attorney at the Mississippi Center for Justice. She represents some of the families directly impacted by yesterday's ICE raids at several companies in Mississippi. Amelia, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
At a news conference, U.S. Attorney Mike Hurst said that Wednesday's immigration raids were not targeting any specific group of people.
Our country is based upon the rule of law. Our jobs in law enforcement is to enforce our laws, and that is what we're doing in this operation.
So how common are these sorts of coordinated immigration raids? I put that question to John Sandweg. He was the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement under President Obama.
Look, this may be normal, but it's the new normal. It's the Trump administration normal, where the idea is to apprehend as many undocumented immigrants as possible, regardless of whether they pose an individualized threat to the country or not. Now, during the Obama administration, candidly, we would not have wasted our resources on the majority of these workers. These are people who are just showing up to work. So if you're thinking about, hey, we want to identify people who pose a public safety threat, who are convicted criminals, or people who are immediately threatening the border, that's not going to be this population. What you're going to find in a place like this, candidly, are people who are probably responsible, showing up for work in order to feed their families. Typically, very few, if any of them, will have a criminal record. This is a dramatically different style, where the overarching goal was to make a big splash by arresting as many people as possible, regardless of whether they pose an individualized threat to the country or not.
And then there are the children left alone crying as their parents were detained. Very upsetting and troubling. What is the long-term impact of these raids on a local community? How do you even gauge that?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, so even after ICE makes the decision that they're going to try to deport these 600 workers, they have another decision to make, which is, are they going to try to detain them immediately during the deportation proceedings? Look, this is going to be very difficult. I would not be surprised if a large number of these workers had been previously ordered deported. And what that allows ICE to do is deport them again very quickly. So I suspect you're going to see a lot of children and perhaps some single parents who are now being deported, and their children are left alone, ultimately to become wards of the state.
John, given the frequency of these kinds of actions under Obama, do you worry that whatever actions you and ICE took might have enabled the current president?
No, I really don't. Listen, these types of operations were conducted during the Obama administration, but again, they were done in such a dramatically different fashion. We executed search warrants where our targets was employers. Our goal was to prosecute the employers who cheat. Oftentimes, these are employers who are exploiting these workers, leveraging the fact that they're undocumented to pay them substandard wages, to work in dangerous conditions, or to work more hours than necessary. ICE should be going after the employers. What I disagree with is that ICE should be moving 600 agents who do critical national security and public safety work to apprehend 600, you know, migrants who basically just showed up for work that day in order to feed their family. The real problem with that, when you look at it from a law enforcement perspective, though, is that just the sheer diversion of resources and the vast amount of resources you need to dedicate to execute that type of strategy means you're dropping the ball on a lot of really important public safety things, including national security investigations, weapons trafficking investigations, child exploitation, and you're dedicating that to apprehending a population that are the kind of people that are not likely to be MS-13 gang members or any of the high-priority targets that you want to apprehend.
John Sandweg served as acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement under President Obama. Thanks for being with us, John.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Ever since independence in 1947, India and Pakistan have had a tense relationship. What changed on Monday is a situation in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The government of Narendra Modi in India surprised the world. It announced that it was incorporating Kashmir into India proper. Kashmir has been at the root of several all-out wars between India and Pakistan.
The people of Kashmir celebrate newly won independence. Their rejoicings tempered by the realization the Kashmir is the stumbling block to peace between India and Pakistan, frontier battles have been going on incessantly.
That was 1948. Just today, Pakistan said it would not take military action in response to India's moves in Kashmir. Shamila Chowdhury was in Barack Obama's National Security Council as director for Afghanistan and Pakistan. She's now a senior fellow at the think tank New America in Washington. Shamila, are you surprised by Pakistan's ruling out military action today?
I'm not surprised because I believe that they don't really have any options militarily. What I am surprised by is that it's a very pragmatic and honest decision that much of the international community probably didn't expect it to make. But it's a kind of smart move because it puts the ball in Modi's court. And I think that the ultimate outcome of that will be that the international community is going to be more focused on Kashmir than they ever have been. Kashmir has been an issue that's been virtually ignored by the international community and the United States in particular. And now Modi has just made it an international issue.
What about the people of Kashmir itself? I mean, it's the only Muslim-majority territory in India, and many of its people do not want to be a part of India. What do you know about reaction on the ground?
Well, it's hard to assess full reaction on the ground because there remains a communications blackout. I know from what reports we have received that people are very scared about the fact that politicians, mainstream politicians in Kashmir have been put under house arrest. That's unusual. They're going to be really, really aggravated by the increased military presence that's there now. The other thing that Kashmiris are worried about is the revocation of the act that now allows non-Kashmiris to go in and settle in Kashmir and buy property. Now, the Indians will tell you that the reason they're doing that is that they need more business and private sector involvement, and the local Kashmiri population is not enough to stimulate that.
Sounds like settlements on the West Bank if they do go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of kind of the regional perspectives are alluding to, is that this is very much akin to the way that the Israelis treat the Palestinians. And that is never a good kind of calling card for any politicians to use, especially in a region where there's like such a large Muslim population that has emotional attachment to the Palestinian cause. And I think that's another potential flashpoint.
Shamila, what is the U.S. concern here? Like, if you were still in the White House, what would be your advice?
Well, the concern for the U.S. is nuclear escalation. And my advice would be for the United States to gather its other like-minded partners, such as the U.K., perhaps other countries that have relationships with India and Pakistan, China, Turkey, the Saudis, and to use all these levers of influence to talk down both sides. So I anticipate that that kind of conversation has already been started. And my recommendation would be to do it as privately as possible and not to have any kind of public conversation about it.
Is there also American concern, or are you worried that Kashmir could become a cause for extremists like ISIS?
Absolutely. I mean, the ISIS is already in the region and the local governments are having problems in managing that. I don't think it's as the ISIS threat has grown as large as we anticipated, those of us who are in the counterterrorism space. But absolutely. What India has done is essentially a calling card for any jihadists in the region to kind of take up arms and organize themselves. This is going to aggravate all of those folks and put everyone more at risk, including the Pakistanis, because if they don't respond militarily to what's happening in Kashmir, Pakistani militants could also start to attack the Pakistani state. So Modi has essentially put the whole region into a much broader kind of threat environment by taking this one action.
Very complicated. Shamila Chowdhury, a former director for Afghanistan and Pakistan on the National Security Council. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Italy's new law against migrant rescue ships is coming under scrutiny. The ships that help people cross the Mediterranean face more than $1 million fine for entering Italian waters. The captains of those ships face arrest. The UN Refugee Agency says these new rules could put migrants in danger. Case in point, a rescue ship with as many as 120 migrants on board is currently in the Mediterranean looking for a port to disembark. The vessel was refused entry to Italy this week. An official on the ship told Euronews that the situation is getting desperate.
Little by little, we are running out of food and drink for the rescued people and for us as a crew. Therefore, we urgently need a boarding port as quickly as possible for the safety of all people on board.
The Italian island of Sicily is about 100 miles from the African coast. Two topics dominate the headlines in Sicily: migrants and the mafia, or La Cosa Nostra, as the Sicilian mafia is known. In the last couple of years, migrants and the mafia have become more and more intertwined. The World's Orla Barry went to Sicily to find out more.
My first port of call is the office of Addio Pizzo in Palermo. It's a grassroots group that encourages local businesses to stand up to the mafia. Chiara Utro, their spokesperson, shows me the group's slogan painted high up across the wall in the office.
People who pay the protection money are people without dignity.
The protection money she refers to is known as Pizzo, and businesses across Sicily have been paying it for decades. But some have refused. I'm meeting one of them, a shopkeeper originally from Bangladesh, who together with 10 other migrant business owners decided to take on the mafia. He doesn't want to give his name for fear of retribution. I ask him how the intimidation started.
Can you explain what happened?
At the very beginning, they put glue at the main entrance, or people very violent and aggressive, broken at the door.
Placing glue in the locks of stores is typically the first action the mafia takes to intimidate shopkeepers. The money they demanded varied. Some weeks it was 10 or 20 euros, other times 50. Things got really serious when he moved his store to a long boulevard that runs through central Palermo, via Makeda.
He remembers very well that the first day in Via Makeda, extortionists entered into his shop and asked him to open the safe box. And they broken part of his shop.
After almost 10 years of paying the pizzo, the shop owner appealed to Addio Pizzo for help. Addio Pizzo effectively means goodbye pizzo, goodbye protection money. Spokesperson Chiara Utro says such a move was completely unheard of among the migrant community.
For us it was a surprise because we are in Palermo more than 10 years and for the first time foreign people knocked at our door asking for some help.
Addio Pizzo encouraged the business owners to come together and go to the authorities. The strategy worked. Police arrested 9 members of the mafia a few weeks later, charging them with a series of offences, including extortion, robbery, arson and assault. In reality, though, the pizzo is not just about making money.
It's a cultural and social matter. For example, mafia used to ask for protection money not to become more rich, but to become more powerful over the territory.
While I'm in Sicily, I read news reports about the mafia's territory and how it's under threat, not by local store owners or the police, but by what journalists and Italian politicians call the Nigerian mafia. There is a report about a police operation in which 19 Nigerians are arrested. Newspaper headlines call them members of the violent Nigerian mafia. I go to meet photojournalist Francesco Bellina. He's been covering the activities of the mafia for many years. Bellina doesn't believe it's fair to use the term Nigerian mafia to describe what he sees as drug dealing and trafficking by some migrant groups. He says migrants are involved with the Sicilian mafia, but are working for them as opposed to encroaching on their territory. And many, he says, are not even Nigerian, but come from other West African countries. Bellina says the Sicilian mafia uses migrants to do the work it doesn't want to be associated with.
There's a an ethic code for mafia. Since I was a child, I remember that nobody can sell the heroin, for example.
Heroin.
It's simple to understand. If you are controlling a territory, an area, a neighborhood, you need that people are with you. People have to defend you. And if you start to sell heroin and people start to die because of your drug, people start to look you, to watch you bad.
So if Sicilian mafia is so concerned about his reputation, I wonder how they feel about the so-called Nigerian mafia making all the headlines recently. Belina says they're probably quite pleased.
They are very happy because if you change the target, if you change the focus, not the mafia, so the real mafia, Sicilian mafia, but migrants, they are very happy because people are going there to look for black men.
Proprio oggi c'è stata un'operazione delle forze dell'ordine in Italia.
This is far-right Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini complaining about illegal immigrants from Africa in Italy. Salvini has aligned himself with those who say Nigerians are posing a criminal threat, which greatly irritates Osas Egbon. She is Nigerian. Egbon established a group to help Nigerian women trafficked to Sicily as sex slaves. She herself was trafficked to Italy over 15 years ago.
The street life is a very bad life. It's not a place for a human, especially for a woman. Especially when a woman sleeps with thousands of men, is something that is very bad.
Egbon says that although Nigerians have been involved in sex trafficking, using the term Nigerian mafia is just not accurate. And she worries it tarnishes all Nigerian migrants with the same brush. She says journalists are partly to blame.
The first thing the journalists will say, they will say, oh, they have arrested Nigeria's mafias. After the last arresting of some people, we decide to declare that as far as all Italians are not mafia, all Nigerians are not mafia.
The migrant shopkeepers, on the other hand, have been getting lots of positive press in Italy. The Bangladeshi shopkeeper in Palermo tells me many other migrants have since thanked him for confronting the mafia. I ask him if he now feels safe.
È paradiso rispetto a inferno.
Okay, now I move from the hell to the heaven. I am not scared. My family may freely walk in the streets. So we feel comfortable.
And you don't think that anyone will come back and seek a pizzo again or seek revenge for what's happened?
Non è solo paura perché chiedono per pizzo.
I don't feel scared. In any case, I prefer to die than paying again pizzo.
Hopefully that will never happen. All the mafia members arrested were convicted and are now awaiting sentencing. None of them, by the way, are Nigerian. They're all local Sicilians. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Sicily.
Waiting in Tijuana, Mexico, we have the story of Jeff, a Honduran man hoping one day to be granted asylum in the U.S.
There's just mattresses on the floor and not much else. It's day 279 for Jeff in Tijuana.
That's coming right up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH in Boston, PRI, and PRX. The Trump administration has made it very clear it wants to crack down on migrants entering the U.S. One way it's trying to do that is through the Remain in Mexico program. That's an arrangement the administration made with the Mexican government to keep asylum seekers, mostly from Central America, in Mexico while their cases are processed in U.S. courts. The World's Monica Campbell looks at how this policy is playing out for one young Honduran in limbo in Tijuana. His story wraps up our series, The Waiting Room, stories of migrants waiting in Mexico, hoping to enter the U.S.
Jeff? Hola, ¿qué tal?
I meet Jeff Mendoza at his apartment building in Tijuana. It's in the city's red light district, and that's an area where migrants can afford to rent rooms by the week or month. Jeff's 27 years old, stocky, with short black hair and a black Ramones t-shirt on. He's a big punk rock fan.
Okay.
We get to the top floor, and Jeff has to work a padlock to get into his room.
Y compartimos el cuarto entre los cuatro.
He shares the small room with three others, also migrants.
De Honduras, Nicaragua, y otro es mexicano.
There's just mattresses on the floor and not much else. It's day 279 for Jeff in Tijuana. Back in Honduras, he worked at a store and lived in an area heavily controlled by gangs. Jeff says one afternoon the police stormed into his home saying they were looking for a suspect and murdered his dad. Jeff isn't clear why, and he and his family demanded answers. They took their case to human rights groups, and that triggered death threats from gang members that Jeff says work with the police. Jeff fled Honduras with his sister and her kid. In Tijuana, Jeff's sister and her kid were allowed into the U.S. They live in Denver now. But Jeff had to follow a new Trump administration policy that keeps some asylum seekers in Mexico while their cases proceed in U.S. courts. It's known as the Remain in Mexico policy. It's supposed to work like this. Immigration officials bring asylum seekers in Mexico across the border to see a judge in the United States. After the hearing, the migrants are returned to Mexico. The process can involve several hearings over many months. Thousands of migrants are in this program. Jeff shows me his paperwork. His experience with the Remain in Mexico policy has been disastrous. He says when he was escorted to his first court hearing in San Diego, U.S. officials took away his backpack, but never returned it. No explanation, Jeff says.
La cual yo traía documentos que hacía constar que yo corría riesgo en mi país, mi mochila con mi celular, tarjeta de débito.
The bag had his passport, documentation for his asylum case, his phone, and cash. Then he was scheduled for a second court hearing this summer. But when the date was moved, Jeff wasn't notified. He didn't have a way to receive mail at his building, so he missed that second crucial court hearing. This has happened to others in the Remain in Mexico program. And some U.S. officials have called the scheduling changes glitches.
Y el caso mío está cerrado, está concluido. El caso mío lo cerraron.
Jeff worries that glitch torpedoed his chance at asylum. It's true. As of now, his case is terminated, and it's unclear whether he can reopen it. U.S. immigration officials didn't respond to my questions about Jeff's case. Jeff says he'll try and push his case forward on his own, but he's feeling worn down.
Creo que con esta forma del MPP que ha hecho el gobierno de Estados Unidos de volver personas a Tijuana para...
He says that's the aim of the Remain in Mexico program, to wear migrants down and convince them to return home. Jeff doesn't want to do that, but he says that some days he feels just as unsafe here in Tijuana as in Honduras.
Obviamente, donde estoy viviendo es una de las zonas más peligrosas de Tijuana.
I live in a dangerous part of town, he says. He shows me two fresh scars on his forearm, knife wounds from when a group of guys stole his new phone. He says he's been robbed here several times, including by the police. Many migrants waiting out their U.S. court cases in Mexico have also reported kidnappings and other assaults. Meantime, he works at a construction site 6 days a week to pay for food.
Nos toca como $15 por persona.
And rents about $15 a week. To escape, he listens to music. Along with the Ramones, his favorite band is Bad Brains. Back in Honduras, he played bass in a band, and he shows me a video they put on YouTube. It's hardcore punk and protest music against the president of Honduras. Just this week, calls for the president's resignation are intensifying based on allegations that he financed his campaign with narco cash. Jeff says he's afraid to go back to Honduras. He's abandoned his country. He misses his relatives and bandmates, but that life feels far away, and he's not sure where his new one will be. For the world, Monica Campbell, Tijuana.
Puerto Rico has a new governor. Her name is Wanda Vasquez. As of right now, she is the third person to hold that title in 1 week's time. I say right now because yesterday, the Supreme Court in Puerto Rico revoked the previous governor's authority, ruling that his appointment was unconstitutional. Eduardo Batia is the minority leader in the Puerto Rican Senate. He's also announced a run for governor in 2020. Let me ask you first, Senator Batio, what are your thoughts about Wanda Vasquez? Because a week ago she said she didn't want to be governor. How does this look for what happens next in Puerto Rico?
Well, I mean, her position, I think, and her statements have been part of the roller coaster that Puerto Rico has lived over the course of the last 2 weeks. First, a popular uproar by citizens, and the Supreme Court yesterday, 9-0, decided that Mr. Pierluisi, who had replaced Mr. Rosselló, had taken the oath of office illegally. So he was replaced then by the Attorney General, Secretary of Justice, Wanda Vasquez. I mean, this is to be honest, Marco, a plot that not even on House of Cards you could see.
I mean, there's still a political crisis, and there doesn't really seem to be a clear pathway to what Puerto Rico's future would be. Can you make the argument why any politician would want to be the governor of Puerto Rico right now?
Let's put this in the context, not just of the political crisis, but Puerto Rico is also in a financial crisis. We filed for bankruptcy. Second, Puerto Rico was the center of a very severe hurricane in August of 2017. And many families are still waiting to get the necessary help to rebuild their homes. There are still over 50,000 families, 50,000, that have these blue tarps on their rooftops because they don't have a roof. And a federal aid has been allocated for Puerto Rico, but it's not flowing in. And the reason that the federal government is not really allocating the funds to Puerto Rico, they claim it has to do with instability, the local political instability. And part of the new governor, part of why I want to be the new governor, has to do with the fact that there are many adults in Puerto Rico. And there are many people who can provide the kind of leadership that Puerto Rico needs right now to overcome, or at least to make the government a stable place for progress to take place.
The sense I get is that citizens in Puerto Rico are just fed up with mainstream politics and politicians
yes.
altogether. What kind of anger do you face as a politician who's been in the business for 20 years in Puerto Rico?
A lot of people are very angry out there. Citizen anger is at an all-time high in Puerto Rico, and so is it in so many other places of the world. And I think that democratizing the democracy of Puerto Rico, allowing citizens to introduce bills and having citizens' initiatives is part of the conversation that we have to entertain in Puerto Rico, and part of why I am pushing forward not only my candidacy, but I think, you know, opening up the political process, opening up the primary process, and basically encouraging anyone and everyone who wants to participate in politics in Puerto Rico to run for office. I think Puerto Rico needs, you know, someone to push the button and say, let's restart and let's build something on the democratic premises and values that we all share.
Senator Batia, if next week Puerto Ricans are back in the streets, dissatisfied with Governor Wanda Vasquez,
yes.
what do you say to them?
Well, I say to them they have every right. You know, the democracy has to be celebrated, and I'm so proud. I'm so proud of the people of Puerto Rico, and I'm so proud of young people. I'm so proud of the millennials. I'm so proud of the people who are saying, you know, enough is enough.
Eduardo Batia, the minority leader of the Puerto Rican Senate, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, doesn't hide his views about women and the LGBT community. He's made light of rape. He's also been quoted as saying he would prefer to see his own son dead rather than gay. Maria Beraldo is not taking any of this lightly. She's a singer-songwriter who's writing music in defiance of Brazil's far-right president. Sonia Narang has her story.
When I meet Maria Beraldo, she has the word trouble emblazoned in bold black letters on her bright red pants.
Enquanto eu não ouço sua voz, eu não sei dizer se é um homem ou uma mulher.
Beraldo released her first solo album last year, and she's gaining fans with her provocative, opinionated lyrics. In a country where the president has openly bashed women and gays, her songs of empowerment and lesbian lovers are a direct challenge.
We have something like a dictator. Our government is being closed. One of the most powerful technologies of the oppression is to silence a lot of stories. In Brazil, I think we have a lot of artists and people and everybody thinking and talking about freedom and putting themselves out.
While Brazil has relatively strong legal protections for LGBT people, anti-gay violence runs high there. And Beraldo fears it's getting worse under Jair Bolsonaro.
And I think we are actually in a moment now that is really complicated. It's really hard in Brazil. Now we have, like, terrible numbers. Lesbophobia is growing.
Minha mãe não era Minha mãe não era Minha avó nasceu no interior de mim.
Beraldo is a classically trained clarinetist. She's 31 now and lives in Sao Paulo. And she's been playing music for as long as she can remember.
Actually, I started in my mother's... How can I say? My mother's body, because she's a musician. And my mother and my parents are musicians, so I always had this at home.
Minha mãe não era Minha mãe não era
In this song, Maria, she creates a world revolving around women by telling her story through the stories of her mother and grandmother. She says men have long been telling stories through their own perspective, leaving women out.
And a lot of histories are being silenced. My album is telling my history, and I think that is really powerful for a lesbian woman to say her history.
Traditionally, we don't have so many singers that things as a lesbian, putting this kind of voice in the lyrics.
Perla Matias is a sociologist and music researcher in Sao Paulo.
So Maria Beraldo is doing this. When she passes this kind of message, it's kind of resistance in an artistic way, in an aesthetic way, and in a political way.
Uma cavala, ela cavalaria, ela tão lisa.
Beraldo's album is titled Cavala. That's also the name of the single. The word cavalo is masculine and means horse in Portuguese, but cavala is an offensive slang term for women. And in this song, Beraldo reclaims the word.
And then I think that word has the strength of the animal and the strength that was taken from us. Like, men are strong, men are brave, men are like the horse. And actually, we are that. We are supporting everything. And we are, like, women had that strength much more than them. So it was a word that started to come out in my life because of this music.
Ela cavala uma selvageria sua tão linda, coisa tão lisa.
Sociologist Perla Matias says Beraldo's music sends a message to girls and young women.
And I think that it's important in this conservative moment. This music can say to them, you can do whatever you want being a woman.
Beraldo's live concerts attract thousands of people across Brazil. And she spreads her message through social media as well. Her Instagram following has grown to more than 16,000.
I think that a lot of women and a lot of lesbian women listen to my history and identify, and that gives a lot of strength for those people. The way that we can start to change things is to let each person tell her history.
For the world, this is Sonia Narang.
In Gimli, Manitoba, there's a community that feels as Icelandic as it does Canadian. Gimli is actually part of New Iceland, and this week thousands of people flock there to celebrate the town's immigrant roots. Laurie Bertram was among the revelers at the 130th Icelandic Festival of Manitoba. She's the author of The Viking Immigrants, Icelandic North Americans, and hails from Icelandic stock herself. Bertram gave me the lowdown on how New Iceland was settled.
Like a lot of other North American immigrant groups, Icelanders were going through a hard time in the 1860s and 70s. And so they began to look for a new place to settle together, particularly to preserve their language and culture, and also their faith. The Canadian government at the time was trying to attract European settlers to this newly acquired territory that they had gotten. So Icelanders were one of the ethnic groups that headed into the Canadian Northwest. And New Iceland was a reserve, actually, that the Canadian government created to kind of entice them to come. So here was a place where they could create a new Iceland in North America.
So when the Icelanders first landed in Canada, where was it, on the East Coast, like Quebec or Newfoundland?
That's right. They landed in Quebec City. In Canada, that's where a lot of the immigrants coming west came through. A substantial portion of them headed into the U.S. So you can actually find Icelandic families in North Dakota, in Minnesota, and places like that. Often they'd settle around the Norwegians and the Swedes, probably so that they could also get good coffee and and jobs.
So has that plan to preserve their culture in this Icelandic community, has that worked out?
In a way, yes, it has. There were a lot of foods, long-standing Icelandic ghost story traditions, which are fascinating, and things like that, like everyday culture, really survived. Icelanders in North America held onto their language for a lot longer, actually, than a lot of other ethnic immigrant groups that came to North America did, in part because language was the heart of Icelandic identity in the 1800s. But over time, especially during the World Wars and the Great Depression, speaking any language other than English was considered to be a sign of treason. This became part of a downward spiral for the Icelandic language in North America. But a lot of people here still speak Icelandic.
You were at the Icelandic festival in New Iceland. Did you hear some Icelandic spoken there?
I did. It was really nice. A lot of Icelanders in Iceland are really curious about Icelandic North Americans, because Iceland lost almost a quarter of its population to mass migration in a very short period of time. So there's a lot of severed family bonds that I don't think ever really got resolved. And that sense of separation and loss has kind of followed people through the generations. Icelanders have fully digitized a massive genealogical database of themselves. So if you know the name of the person that left Iceland, you just have to key it into that. And right away, it'll tell you not if you're related, but how you're related, because everybody is related in Iceland. I've done this with people that I've never met before, and you know, we find out we're related, and they break into tears. I think that really speaks to a sense of loss in Iceland that really hasn't been completely rectified yet.
So whether it's food or ghost stories, do you sense that these traditions have survived because of an almost existential fear that they could disappear? Or do locals maintain them just naturally because they sincerely appreciate the culture?
I think both, you know. I think they serve a function still, all of these things. They're still very much part of a living culture that's useful and beautiful in everyday life. One of our favorite foods, and it's kind of almost a sacred representation of our decision to maintain an identity, is this one kind of cake we call vina tarta. It's a striped little fruit cake, and people are obsessed with vina tarta, and it's the last thing that we have that did not change at all from 1875. Actually, a lot of non-Icelanders love vina tarta and make it. My aunt on my dad's side, I'm Scottish on my dad's side, my auntie Linda is our family vina tarta maker, and she makes it. You know, people here still feel very Icelandic. These traditions are part of making it tangible, you know, making it real and part of your everyday life.
Laurie Bertram is the author of The Viking Immigrants, Icelandic North Americans. Laurie, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
The British, when it comes to sport, they're crazy about a few of them. Soccer, rugby, cricket, Formula One, but not basketball. That makes our next story seem all the more extraordinary. Abdi Jama is a European hoops champion. He plays wheelchair basketball for Team GB, a.k.a. Great Britain. The BBC's Isaac Fainan has his profile.
Abdi Jama left Somalia at the age of 6 years old to escape the civil war there. He moved to Liverpool in England with his family and began to build a new life. But 8 years later, a tragic accident.
I was sitting on a windowsill, and basically the window was wide open. I didn't realise. As I leaned back, I went straight through the window because it was wide open and damaged my back. Woke up 2 weeks later in hospital
What was it like when you woke up and they told you that you might not be able to walk again?
I'm one of them people that believe in, you know, things happen for a reason. And, you know, even at 14 years old, I was quite mature for my age. So, I remember when the consultant came over and my mum was there, you had psychologists, all these other people was there, and they told me that I couldn't walk. And my first reaction was, okay, you know, I'm actually lucky to be alive. You know, apparently I died twice in a coma or something. So, you know, I don't remember any of this, but, you know, I was lucky to be alive and I knew that life goes on. A guy came to the school. His name is Adi Orobemi, and he was part of the GB team at that time. He told me, why don't you try, give it a go? And he was like, man, you're good. And seeing this guy do things that I couldn't do was incredible. I could relate to him because a fellow African brother was showing me the ways of how to do stuff.
Abdi has gone on to flourish in the sport, winning pretty much all there is to win in the game.
So do you think you could have achieved anything you achieved like this if you lived in Somalia?
I'd say no. It would be difficult because just let alone being a sportsman, I think just being a disabled athlete,
yeah,
or just being a disabled person, I don't think I would have achieved what I've achieved, yeah, even come close to it.
Obviously, being a GB athlete is an incredible thing to be able to say. How do they make it easy for you guys as athletes?
And, you know, to get that standard to a level that it should be, you need to see, you know, disabled people as athletes, not just as people that are disabled. For me, I would love to go back home and, you know, do stuff back home as well, even for myself. Yeah. One day, maybe coach the Somaliland teams.
Wow, he made sure life does go on. Wheelchair basketball champ Abdi Jama speaking with the BBC's Isaac Fainan. And that's it for us today. Our theme music was written by Ned Porter. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.